Religion in its contemporary context, religious experience. This morning, Professor John McMurray gives the second of his two talks on this subject, in which he asks the question, what makes an experience religious?
Today, we must try to think sensibly about religious experience itself. Last week, we asked about the kind of ordinary experience that produced religion. Now we have to ask what kind of experience is religious. I think we had better divide this subject into two parts. First, we shall consider corporate religious experience. I mean the kind of experience we could expect to have by taking part in a religious gathering, like a church service. After that, we can talk about the religious experience that is private and individual. Let's start then where we ended last week, with the family, which I called, you may remember, the primary religious fact. Let's ask some questions about it. What makes people members of the same family? You may say, oh, they are blood relations, father, mother, and children. But wait a minute. If we say blood relations, won't we have to include grandparents and uncles and aunts and even cousins? Where do we stop? Or suppose that the children are adopted. Aren't they members of the family? In that case, blood relationship is out. Suppose we say that they feel they belong to one another and care for one another. They don't always, of course, but we expect them to, and we think it natural that they should. I leave you to argue this out. For what I am after is that you do find groups of people who have this sense of belonging and who care for one another, without being blood relations. Will you agree to say that they are groups of the family type? They are sometimes called brotherhoods. Well now, I suggest that religious groups are of this type. What unites them is their sense of belonging and that they care for one another. Again, they don't always, but this is what we expect of them. Another question. What are we to say of those members of the family who are dead? My own father died many years ago, but he is still a strong influence in my life. And when I begin to think about this, another image of the family arises. The one set out in a family tree. The family goes back in time to the most distant ancestors, and it goes on into the future. Then we who are alive are only temporary representatives of the family, members of a succession. The family remains. Its members come and go. To feel this deeply, to feel that you are a temporary and ephemeral being, yet part of something that remains, is to have a religious experience. Indeed, it lies at the basis of a great deal of primitive religion, especially in the form of ancestor worship. I can't leave the family without reminding you of its celebrations, birthday celebrations to begin with. What is a celebration anyway? If the school football team wins an important match, it may celebrate the victory with a dinner. The dinner will be a special dinner. Why special? Because it is symbolic. It has a meaning which is not just eating and drinking. It means we belong together, and we are proud and glad of it. So when the family celebrates a birthday, or the brother, say, we are saying we belong to him, he belongs to us, we are glad he was born, and we are happy that he is one of us. And we bring him our presents as love tokens. If this little celebration is real to us, if we feel it like this, deep in our hearts, as we say, then it is a religious experience. Then there is the celebration of Christmas, which is very much a family celebration. But it goes beyond the family, for it is the celebration of the birth of Jesus long ago. Did you think of that last Christmas? Or was it all fun and games and presents and a big dinner? If that was all, then you missed its whole significance. For it is a way of saying, we are glad that Jesus was born for our salvation, and we are happy and proud to belong to him. So far as we felt this, really deep in our heart, it was quite a profound religious experience. Might it be true, do you think, that wherever we have this feeling of belonging, accompanied by a lifting of the heart in gladness about it, we are having a religious experience? I am inclined to think it is. You will be wondering when I am going to arrive at religion proper, what goes on in churches and all that. Very well, but what I have to say is not very different, even if it is on a bigger scale. The big difference is that Christianity is a universal religion, and its symbols refer to the whole human race. St. Paul talks about the whole family in heaven and earth. And he told the Athenians on a famous occasion that God had made of one blood all nations of men. Remembering this, we might say that a body of Christians gathered together for worship is concerned with a celebration. It is a complex celebration, which means for them, first, we belong together with all Christians everywhere, and we are glad of it. Second, we belong to them because we all belong to Christ, who is the common Lord and Master. Third, we dedicate ourselves afresh to the purpose of God which Christ revealed to us, the setting up of his kingdom on earth, to the union of all people in the world in one great family with God as a Father. This third element, which refers to the future, is a sort of rejoicing in hope or in anticipation, and it is not really new. If you go back over the celebrations we have talked about, you will find it there too. Just try it. It is quite possible, or even likely, that many of those present in such a gathering will fail to realize all this. Some may be merely onlookers. But so far as they do realize it, and so far as it is deeply felt, they have together a common and profound religious experience. Some of you, I feel sure, will want to get back at me and to say they come together to worship God. Why not say that and be done with it? My answer is that I want to begin with it now when I turn to talk about the religious experience of the individual. Of course, there is much more than I have expressed in any act of public worship. But most of what there is depends upon the the religious quality of the individuals who are present. As for being done with it, I should only be beginning. Others of you would say, then, what is God, if there is God anyway, and what is worship? In a sense, everyone knows that God stands at the center of religion. Yet a young man for whom I have a great admiration and affection told me that the word God had no meaning whatever for him. I am told that it is fashionable in some quarters for young people to profess that they are atheists. Well, passions change, and they mean nothing to anybody who is seeking truth. If your atheism is really serious, it probably means that you can't believe any longer in the God you imagined for yourself when you were a child. I am sure you are right. But perhaps you might remember that you can believe even less in the world you imagined then. Ah, you will say, but the world is there all right. Can you prove that God exists? Of course not. You can never prove existence. There was a story when I was at university about a brilliant student who was found in the early morning wandering in the college garden in a state of great distress. When he was taken indoors and calmed down, he explained that he had been sitting up all night trying to prove that he existed, and he couldn't. You don't prove existence, you experience it. So I shall not talk about God's existence, not even about belief in God, because a belief must have a foundation to rest on. What I am concerned about is the experience of God, for this is surely the central religious experience on which all the others depend. I have a strong belief that everyone, or almost everyone, has the experience of God. How else can one explain that men have worshipped some god or other from the most primitive times and still do? Atheism has always been abnormal, and that so many intelligent people profess it today shows what an abnormal society we live in. But many people, and particularly today, fail to recognize their experience of God for what it is, no doubt because it is so different from what they expect. The ways in which men experience God are very various. I can only take from my own experience what seems inseparable from it and hope that it is common to them all. The experience of God is found at the deepest level of our existence. This reference to depth is, of course, metaphorical, but it is so universal and familiar that I feel sure the metaphor will not bother you. If it does, think of some common examples. Think of the song of the freedom fighters in the southern states of America. Deep in my heart, I do believe we shall overcome someday. But if someone said to you, I love you from the bottom of my soul, you would have no doubt what was meant. The metaphor has been given even a scientific standing by the depth psychologists who help their patients to penetrate to deeper and deeper levels of their consciousness. So I can use the metaphor and expect that you will understand. We live most of our life on the surface, going from one interest to another, from one activity to the next. Another way to say this is that we live by a routine and never stop to ask whether what we are doing has any real for a meaning. We go below the surface and are on our way to the depths. And then we find that this is where our real life is, and that the surface life is only show and shadow. None of us can escape from experiences which shatter the surface life and force us into the depths. The death of a dear friend can compel us to plumb the depths of sorrow. A pianist had one of her hands ruined in an accident and had to find a new meaning for her life. Even more significant are those experiences which reveal you to yourself. Suppose that at a party you make a malicious jest at the expense of one of your friends. And that night, when you are alone and the excitement is over, you realize just what you have done. And you are ashamed of yourself. "What a selfish, cruel creature I am," you say, "who could destroy a friendship for the sake of a joke." Where does the shame come from? What is it in you that puts you in the dock and judges you and demands that you make amends? Conscience, you may say, but that is only a word. You discover in the depths of yourself something that calls you to account, to which you are responsible. Should one not rather say, to whom you are responsible? More than a person. To myself, then, but does this mean anything? And if the same action had been done by someone else, would you not recognize that the same judgment would apply to him? The responsibility, it would seem, must be to a universal person. An older generation used to call conscience the voice of God in us. To me it seems that in the depths of such self-judgment, there is at least an experience of God. Let me then, in closing, dare to generalize. Whenever we are driven into the depths of our own being, or seek them of our own will, we are faced by a tremendous contrast. On the one side, we recognize the pathetic littleness of our ephemeral existence, with no... On the other side, in the depth, there is something eternal and infinite in which our existence, and indeed all existence, is grounded. This experience of the depths of existence fills us with a sense both of reverence and of responsibility, which gives even to our finite lives a meaning and a power which they do not possess in themselves. This, I am assured, is our human experience of God. As Paul Tillich, that great theologian and prophet whom we have so recently lost, has said, "He who knows about depth knows about God."
Professor John McMurray has been talking about religious experience in the series Religion in its Contemporary Context.